In an article in the New York Times on November 7th, there's a story about a group of wealthy Americans who have made good in their careers, but have had life-changing epiphanies where they realized they were living in a wealth bubble. The Times article calls these bubbles gilded ghettos, which perpetuate wealth, a sense of safety, and access to a great education, while simultaneously, albeit unintentionally, excluding others from these same opportunities. We have concentrations of extreme affluence and then concentrations of extreme poverty. The middle-class neighborhoods, which were seen as pathways to social mobility, are quickly disappearing. And the concept of the American dream seems to be headed in the same direction. In these gilded ghettos, you have people spending time with the kind of people whose lifestyle most resembles their own. And as the article states, it creates an echo chamber of beliefs and expectations that further separate the have-mores from everyone else. Without encountering people from other classes and less fortunate circumstances, our common humanity and empathy are eroded. In 2015, Robert D. Putnam, a professor of public policy at Harvard, published his book entitled Our Kids, the American Dream in Crisis. Putnam explains, quote, "We Americans like to think of ourselves as rugged individuals in the image of the lone cowboy riding toward the setting sun, opening the frontier. But at least as accurate a symbol of our national story is a wagon train with its mutual aid among a community of pioneers. Throughout our history, a pendulum has slowly swung between the poles of individualism and community, both in our public philosophy and in our daily lives. In the past half century, we have witnessed, for better or for worse, a giant swing toward the individualist or libertarian pole in our culture, society, and politics. At the same time, researchers have steadily piled up evidence of how important social context, social institutions, and social networks, in short, our communities, remain for our well-being and our kids' opportunities." End quote. One of the strongest points of Putnam's book is that rather than showing an endless amount of graphs and tables, he concentrates on family stories in both impoverished ghettos and so-called gilded ghettos. But first, he takes us back to the community he grew up in the 1950s, Port Clinton, Ohio. Putnam contends that in this decade, according to the most rigorous economic and social history, socioeconomic barriers were at their lowest ebb in more than a century. Economic and education expansion were high, income equality was relatively high, and class segregation in neighborhoods and schools was low. There were, in effect, abundant opportunities for kids from the lower classes to scale the socioeconomic ladder. He gives us examples of working-class kids from the 50s, such as Don, whose father worked two jobs to keep his family afloat. They had no car, no television, ate hash nearly every night. However, Don didn't think of himself as poor and was encouraged by his parents to pursue the college prep track in high school. Though the parents were clueless about college, Don's pastor helped him get into a local university. He became a minister, married a high school librarian, and lived a solid, satisfying middle-class existence. Frank, on the other hand, came from one of the wealthiest families in town. His parents were well-educated and socially prominent. It was not unusual at that time for kids like Don and Frank to be friends. Many in the high school were unaware of Frank's family's wealth. His family made him work, and he was told not to brag about his wealth. His grandfather told him to always order the same things in a restaurant that his friends could afford to order. He also went to college, became a newspaper editor, and although never became wealthy himself, admits that a small trust fund has sheltered him from some of life's hard knocks. Putnam explains that because the transmitters of socioeconomic status that are so potent today, economic insecurity, family instability, neighborhood distress, financial and organizational barriers, were unimportant in that period, the transmission process from generation to generation was weaker and thus mobility was higher. Over and over, Putnam claims his classmates' memories include the phrase, "We were poor, but didn't know it." Present-day Port Clinton is a very different place, according to Putnam. Rich and poor no longer intermingle as they did in Putnam's day. We meet Chelsea, whose family has two expensive homes and treats her to such luxuries as limo pickups for her 11th birthday party, and whose mother brags about being a thorn in the side of school administrators who won't change her daughter's grades when they're dissatisfied with them, even bragging about having an uncooperative teacher reassigned. Chelsea's mother is skeptical about funding education for poor kids. She says, quote, "If my kids are going to be successful, I don't think they should have to pay other people who are sitting around doing nothing for their success," end quote. In contrast to Chelsea, there's David. David's mother moved out when he was young and has lived with a succession of boyfriends who David characterizes as nuts. His father has had custody of David, though he has been in and out of prison and constantly battled drug problems. David's family life was so chaotic, he mostly stayed away from home, hung out with friends, smoked marijuana to escape home life. David went to 7 different elementary schools, was transferred from middle school to a behavior school after getting in several fights, and eventually went to a career-based high school where he got credit for working in a hamburger joint, which fired him immediately after he graduated. David has had various temporary jobs, but lost his opportunity for his dream job as a foreman at a landscaping company because he had points on his driver's license. His girlfriend became pregnant when he was in high school, and now in addition to caring for younger siblings, he has a young daughter to care for. His prospects are indeed bleak. There are others discussed in this book, but they require another show. Blacks and women had markedly less opportunities in the 1950s. Blacks were almost entirely segregated, although the community support they received from their churches and families in their neighborhood was much stronger then than it is now. Women often went to college, but seldom completed their education as they got married and started families. What Putnam asks us to look at is the conception of equality. Most Americans are used to a degree of inequality in income and wealth. We tend not to begrudge others their success or care how high the socioeconomic ladder is, Putnam says, assuming that everyone has an equal chance to climb it, given equal merit and energy. However, we as a society are very concerned with equality of opportunity and social mobility. We want all people to be able to get onto the ladder at the same place, so to speak. Historically, this country, with the absence of a pre-existing feudal social structure, Putnam says, helped create and sustain an egalitarian social structure. The vastness of the American frontier, with its land virtually free to the new settlers, made the ideal of unlimited social mobility seem obtainable. In 1843, McGuffey's Reader, the first national school textbook, told readers, "The road to wealth, to honor, to usefulness, and happiness is open to all, and all who will may enter upon it with the almost certain prospect of success." Now we seem to have two Americas. An America where parents start educating their children at a young age, reading to them, eating dinner with them, making plans for the future with them. And an America where children are, from an early age, passed from one guardian to another, exposed to stress at home, stress in schools where they're exposed to violence and chaos, and given little hope of rising above their circumstances. Putnam addresses what needs to be done and tells us why it needs to be done. He says, quote, "Why should the opportunity gap matter for those of us on its lucky side? The answer is that the destiny of poor kids in America has broad implications for our economy, our democracy, and our values." I might add that for many of us, this type of inequality is simply morally unacceptable. Putnam's suggestions range from avoiding unplanned pregnancy by providing contraception, expanding child tax credits, protecting long-standing anti-poverty programs, expanding preschool programs such as Head Start, reducing prison sentencing for nonviolent crime, rehabilitation and education programs for ex-prisoners, an emphasis on links between schools and the community, and more emphasis on technical education programs and community colleges. Sadly, many of these programs and initiatives are currently underfunded and in the process of being defunded. Our society has some choices to make. One group of wealthy residents in Atlanta was inspired to do something in their community after reading Putnam's book. The group has committed $350,000 over 2 years with a focus on increasing school attendance and parental involvement, helping children get a little further up that ladder whose rungs seem to be getting farther and farther apart. When we speak of the American dream, I like to think of it as the dream of an ideal America, one where equality of opportunity is prized and where privilege is married with responsibility for those lower on the ladder. We have some interesting insights tonight from a Vietnamese immigrant and playwright, a Greek immigrant and international studies professor, an economics professor, and some of Kansas City's most treasured folk musicians. Welcome to this very special edition of River City Chautauqua as we look at the American dream. This is Julie Bennett-Hume, producer and co-host of River City Chautauqua, wishing you all a happy Thanksgiving.
Brett Hodges has been a treasure of the folk community in the Lawrence, Kansas City area for over three decades. He is currently a member of Twang Daddies and Brushy Creek and can be seen most Monday nights at the Rural Grit Happy Hour. He's here tonight to sing a couple of folk standards for us.
All right, this is an old tune called Jimmy Brown the Newsboy. And it was originally recorded by the Carter family. Pretty sure it's an A.P. Carter copyright. And a lot of people have done it over the years. One of my favorite, and I'll use a little bit of him toward the end, is a guy named Mack Wiseman, who had a gorgeous voice and sang with all the bluegrass boys and everybody else at one time or another. Goes something like this.
Thank you. My name is V. Tran, and I am a singer-songwriter and actor and venue curator here in Kansas City. I'm a preacher's kid and a butcher's son. I was born in the shadow of Saigon, Vietnam, and raised in the cattle country of southwestern Kansas. So in a lot of ways, I am equal parts sea salt and wheat fields, and I am the American dream. See, my father fought in the Vietnam War, and he was sent to the re-education camps after the war, and he survived. And after I was born, that's when my parents decided to make a break for it. I had an older sister, and then my birth was kind of the catalyst for them making a decision to make a break for it, because they said, you know, it was already hard enough with one child, you know, now we have two, and if we want them to have a fighting chance in life, then we gotta go. And so my family escaped from Vietnam, and we arrived in the States in the mid-80s, and we ended up in Garden City, Kansas. And at the time, the world's largest meatpacking plant opened up 7 miles away in Holcomb, Kansas. It was Iowa Beef Packing at the time, and it's now owned by Tyson. But both of my parents worked there, and so that's why I see myself as a butcher's son. My father left the meatpacking plant when I was in junior high, I think, to become a Southern Baptist minister. And so I don't think it can get any more American than that, despite my origin story. But, you know, I grew up, and my folks worked really, really hard, long hours, working 60, 70 hours at the plant, odd jobs after that. And, you know, they sacrificed a lot so that I could pursue my studies and pursue a life here in America. And when I was young, I thought it was kind of that stereotypical Asian overachieving kid thing that they wanted out of me. You know, I thought, okay, they want a 4.0 student. They want, med school or law school for me. They want an Ivy League school of my choice. And so I really threw myself into academics. But fate would twist for me. I think it was my freshman or sophomore year in high school that my high school toyed around with a really, really stringent grading scale. 94 to 100 was an A. I got a 93.4 in geometry, and the teacher wouldn't round up. And it was my own fault. I was a cocky little smart kid, and so I thought that I could bring my score up, or I thought I could do some extra credit, but, you know, she taught me one of those life lessons. She held me to that grade, and she gave me a B, and it wrecked my 4.0. I thought my life was over. There goes the American dream, right? I was desolate. I was so depressed and so distraught. But then something happened, you know. The following semester, I thought, well, if my life is over anyway, I might as well just do what I want. And so I auditioned for a play, and I got the lead role. And I started a band with some kids from church, and I fell in love with performing. And it was then that my parents kind of shifted my perspective of what the American dream meant to them. They said, we didn't bring you to America to play out a stereotype, you know? We didn't bring you to America to become a doctor or a lawyer, you know? Those are fine professions. We brought you here so that you could choose, so that you could choose what you wanted to be, so that you could have a fighting chance in life, however you saw fit, whatever life you envisioned for yourself, because that's not what you would have had had we stayed. You could see that my parents had a greater vision for what America was to them, and what America could be for me. And it wasn't a stereotype or a box that they wanted to place me in. It was just that freedom, that liberty. And that self-sacrifice, you know, they could have been stereotypical Asian tiger parents themselves and forced me to follow, you know, a set path. This is what we sacrifice for. This is what you should do. But they didn't, you know, and it was with such grace and such permissiveness that they let me choose my own path. And that said, they said, you know, okay, do your theater thing and do your music thing, but keep your grades up. And so I did, you know, I graduated with a 3.9, and I stacked up my activities and my resume, and so I went to college with academic and performing scholarships, and I've continued on that path to this day in adulthood, just pursuing my dreams, but also just trying to share the story of what an American family looks like, what an American family feels like. And for me, it's these four Vietnamese people that you might see walking down the street, a mother, a father, a son, a daughter, you know, who sought new soil and a new chance in life. And we came to America with $20 that a missionary had given to us and the clothes on our backs, and we built from there. And, you know, I took that story and I took my family's story and I wrote a folk musical about it called The Butcher's Son, self-produced it here in Kansas City, toured it throughout Kansas and took it back to some of those meatpacking towns to be able to take it back to those audiences where communities had refugee and immigrant populations, so that they could see that their story was being told too. And while my story has an interesting hook, you know, Vietnam War, escape, lots of exotic details, at its core, I wanted to tell a story about how family stories are passed down, and how family lore is created. And I think that's a very American story, and that's a very human story. And audiences that walk out of that show, it gives me great joy when regardless of race or color or background, they walk out and they say, that's my family, even though it was a different war or even though it was a different generation, you know, whether it was, you know, South American or whether it was Mexican or whether it was Irish or whether it was, you know, a Texan, you know, who is like, hey, I see my father there. You know, I see my mother there. I had a sister who looked out for me. You know, I had folks that really cared about me and wanted the best out of life for me. And so all of a sudden, it's not a Vietnamese family that you see, but your own family. And I think that in times like this, that's really important. You know, that's how we can reach across the aisle and clasp each other's hands and see that the American dream is still alive, you know, because the American dream is us, you know, regardless of what we look like, what we believe, we're here and we're mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers, and all we want is the best for our families. And I think that when we hold that dream up and when we hold those values up and we see that all we're doing is trying to build a life for each other and for the little villages that we create and the communities that we create, that's what a nation is made up of. A nation is made up of cities, but then you take it down to that local level, you know, and nations exist to protect the village, you know, and a village is just made up of a number of clusters of families, you know, and so if families band together, then that's what the nation exists for, is to protect those families and to protect, you know, something that is bigger than us, you know, something that speaks to, the greater angels of our nature. So that's the American dream to me.
Betsy Ellis and Clark Wyatt formed their duo in the fall of 2014 after meeting and realizing a shared love of deep sources of traditional Southern mountain music, along with the draw to create new music. Their music is familiar and totally different, a fiddle and banjo duo with a sense of adventure. We'll hear from Betsy and Clark's original improvisation collection titled American Dream Suite and their version of A Hobo's Vision of Paradise, Big Rock Candy Mountain. This is Scott Easterday for River City Chautauqua. William K. Black is Associate Professor of Economics and Law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He teaches white-collar crime, public finance, antitrust, and Latin American development. Professor Black was Litigation Director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, Deputy Director of the National Commission on Financial Institution Reform, and helped develop an anti-corruption initiative for the World Bank. He is author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One, about the savings and loan scandal of the 1980s. He's appeared on Bill Moyer's Journal to provide commentary on the banking crisis and the recession of 2008, and has testified before Congress in 2010 on the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy. Here's Bill Black.
For the last 40 years, the American dream has been under assault But for the last 10 years, the American dream has actually gone in reverse for tens of millions of Americans. The biggest takeaway about the crisis was, of course, that the estimated cost in GDP is $24.3 trillion. A trillion is 1,000 billion. 9.3 million American jobs were lost. 5 million American jobs that normally would have been created were not created. But for blacks and Latinos, the American dream became absolutely perverse. For whites and for Asian Americans, if you got a university degree, then you suffered. You suffered significantly in the crisis, but you suffered considerably less than your counterparts who didn't have a university degree. But here's what's so strange. If you were black or Latino and you had a college degree, your loss of wealth was much greater than your counterpart who lacked that university degree. For Latino households, you lost 72% of your wealth during the crisis. For Latino households that didn't have a college degree, that loss was 41%. So dramatically greater losses if you tried to do everything that you were told you were supposed to do to achieve the American dream. If you were black, the numbers were similar. You lost 60% of your wealth if you were college educated. If you were not college educated and you were black, your household lost 37% of its wealth. Now, the crisis in a political sense, of course, is being played out overwhelmingly among the white community. All the focus is on how white voters who didn't have college degrees have decided that they're being left out of the American dream, and that, more to the point, their kids are being left out of the American dream. And in some sense, it makes sense because, you know, it's the American whites who don't have college degrees that got it so bad, that lost so much wealth within the white community compared to their college-educated counterparts in the white community. But the folks, of course, who really got it in the neck, vastly worse than the white working class, were the black and Latino non-working class, right? These are the middle class folks, and they've been pretty much ignored in terms of what went wrong. What went wrong, and this is a shame because what went wrong in terms of the American dream, important parts explain all the things we're seeing. So it isn't just the crisis years. It's the last basically 40 years. There has been very, very little growth in income adjusted for inflation for most Americans. The super wealthy, there's been exceptional growth for. But this hasn't brought blacks and Latinos and whites, working class, together. It's led to ever deeper fissures, even though they're all suffering from the same overall component. What's different is if you're black and Latino, you see that the black and Latino middle class and upper middle class is in similar straits in terms of these kinds of losses, that the American dream for them, it isn't just that their kids are going to be poorer. They are dramatically poorer than they were just 10 years ago. So what's happening in all of this? The things that are the same, was it trade, international trade? Not very much. International trade has winners and losers, and there have been a lot of winners, and in particular in our part of the country, agriculture has been a big winner of the trade deals. The losers, of course, have been overwhelmingly in industry. The kind of jobs, when I was born in Detroit, grew up in a suburb of Detroit where Ford Motor Company is headquartered, Dearborn, Michigan. When I was young, you could get $18 an hour on the assembly line, basically twisting a bolt. Those jobs are gone, and they're gone forever. And so all working class Americans are faced by that loss, regardless of whether it was, if we'd had no trade, the U.S. dominance of economics would still have been lost. We can simply make things in industry, big plants, so much more cheaply these days. That it's true that those jobs are largely not going to come back, whatever we do on trade. So it isn't so much trade. It certainly is, however, that now you compete, unless you have very specialized training, with people all over the world. Worse than that, though, is even in the good times, and there have been a number of good times in the sense of low unemployment, it hasn't been a wonderful experience for either the middle class or the working class, and of course not for the poor in the United States. It hasn't been great for the middle class, the working class, because wages have simply refused to go up with things like corporate profitability. And you can see that in the stock market. You can see the stock market reaching record highs. Well, why? Because those gains aren't going to workers, and they're not going to the consumers. They're going overwhelmingly in the form of stock appreciation and dividends. And that money overwhelmingly goes to the top 20%. And so that's part of the frustration. There used to be times in the past when the economy got really good, you got, even if you were working class, you got substantial overtime, sometimes triple time, working on holidays. That has largely gone away, and it's very unlikely to come back. Walmart championed this business model of nobody gets overtime. The way you get to be a store manager is you are rotated out of wherever you are working because they don't want you to know and like the employees. Full employment, even when we have full employment, something like 30% of Walmart workers will need things like federal food stamps. And we're not used to that. We're not used to an American dream where you work hard, you work, you want more hours. They won't give you more hours. And you end up with so little income that if you want your kids to have proper nutrition, you need to be doing food stamps. You're also on the way up when we were recovering from the Great Recession. If you were working class and your kids, weren't able to get college degrees, well, you found that those jobs, yes, we were gaining employment actually pretty steadily, not a great rate, but pretty steadily from 2010 on, certainly. But who was getting the jobs? Well, kids with college degrees were getting hired first. And that's great, except that somewhere, depending on the time period, between 50 and 60% of the jobs they were getting, there's no reason to have a college degree to do those jobs. There's no requirement, no particular reason. So again, if you're working class, you see that your kids are the first to be fired in the Great Recession and the last to be rehired. And even when they're rehired, they often can't get full-time jobs. They have to work multiple jobs. And you're just, treading water. So the economics in terms of the American dream have really put a kibosh on it for decades now. And it's not a little shock to the system. It sends shockwaves through people about how little control they have over their lives. 40% of Americans live in households where if they have an unexpected bill of $400, they can't pay it without either getting a loan or selling an asset. And of course, this is where payday lending comes in. And that is a place that puts, you know, millions of Americans in debt traps that they can't get out of. It is this overall feeling that the American dream is out of reach that helps, we think as criminologists, create the despair that produces the modern aspects of the drug crisis. I mean, how bizarre is it that we now, you know, since the crisis, have had more people die of opioid overdoses than all of our recent wars combined, easily more than all of those wars combined. We have more opioid deaths than gun deaths, than deaths from most forms of tobacco and such in any given year. And we have major pharmaceutical companies pushing these drugs and telling people that they're not addictive and that the risks of overdose is trivial and easily managed. When we see thousands and thousands of people have died. And this is in the midst of this insane continuation of the drug war. I don't know, we're in the 70th year or something of the drug war. It would go on forever. You don't win drug wars. How crazy is it that we have millions of people now who switch from opioids to heroin because heroin's cheaper, much cheaper. Well, heroin's, you know, illegal, and we have all these, you know, programs that you see, these armies, the Drug Enforcement Administration, literal armies all through Latin America, border patrols, customs services, Coast Guard. People have a sense that the world's gone crazy. So the American dream is the dream that brought us all here. It's the reason that my family, my wife's family, you know, that immigrated from Italy, got up every day so happy to have come to America, in my case, to be born in America. The American dream wasn't a fiction. It wasn't a romance novel. It was real. It was real for well over a century and a half, and it's important to bring it back. So there are lots of ways to fix things, and the most fundamental is American pragmatism. We used to do what worked. We used to put people in charge who told the truth, at least most of the time, who were believed that the government was important, believed that it should do help people, that it should work with honest members of industry, that it should establish a rule of law and that would prevent the cheats from gaining a competitive advantage and dominating the market. We used to have effective rules in banking that created a rule of law, kept us safe for 50 plus years. And we did the thing that conservatives always warn about, except it was done largely by conservatives in both parties, which is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Things like Glass-Steagall worked brilliantly for 50 years, dramatically reduced financial crises, and dramatically reduced how much harm was done when you did have a recession. Thank you.
they say is leaving home every day, beating the hot old dusty way to the California line. Across the desert sands they roll, getting out of that old dust bowl. Think they're going to the Sugar Bowl, but here's what they find. Now the police at the port of entry say, you're number 14,000 for the day. If you ain't got do re mi, boys, if you ain't got the do re mi, you better go back to beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee.
My name is Archimedes Kalaitzidis. People call me Akis for short. I am a professor of political science, international relations at the University of Central Missouri, the Department of Government, Languages, International Studies and Languages. And this is my immigrant experience. I actually come from a long line of people who have experienced forced immigration, meaning people who have fled for their lives during war and genocide in the beginning of the 20th century. I grew up in Greece, northern Greece, and I came to the United States in 1989 to study economics and politics. For me, the experience is different than that of my grandparents, because my immigration move was voluntary and was actually wonderful to begin with. When you're 19 years old and you move to a new country, you have new experiences, meet people from all over the world. I landed at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and it's a big school with many intellectual activities, and it was a wonderful time. I got my degree and moved on to Temple University in Philadelphia. But before I did this, I made a life decision to marry an American, and then, of course, built my family here, which makes me now an immigrant in this country for good. And it continued being a great experience in Philadelphia, which is a totally different environment in the United States than what Knoxville, Tennessee was, even, you know. Though Knoxville was a college town and it was fun, Philadelphia is a major urban area with a lot of different problems. You get to see a lot of different things, the different unique aspects of the American culture. And eventually I got a job in Kansas City, Missouri, at the University of Central Missouri in Warrensburg. And it's a different yet part of the country, which has a different cultural and ethnic background, and it's also, again, fascinating. And throughout my study career, I have thought about what my immigrant experience overall is, and I would have to categorize it as a positive experience, although I have also seen changes over the years. It was much different when I came to this country. A lot more openness and friendliness and welcoming than it is now. But, you know, these things, I guess, go in cycles, and I expect that the United States will turn again to be the open country that it used to be and the welcoming people that they have been to me. For other people, we realize that these are difficult times, but we hope that as I had a great experience, more people that are coming to this country seeking a better future would also be able to have the experience that I had. So I feel thankful for that, and I hope that people who listen to the program will realize that, you know, immigrants can be different people, different backgrounds, and can come to this country for different reasons. My grandparents fled what today is modern-day Turkey under the threat of death, basically. I came to this country voluntarily to learn and enjoy, open up my mind and enjoy new worlds, so my experience was totally positive, and I hope that, you know, from this I can, you know, teach people to be open to people who come from around the world to learn and seek to learn and understand this country, and maybe take it back home or even participate in this country as productive citizens. The American dream, for many people, could be different things, of course, and I'm very conscious of that, because for my grandparents, it would probably be surviving and creating a family where they can feed and, you know, take care of their children. But for me, coming from a more advanced country, Greece, in the 1990s, there wasn't so much the look for the immediate gratification as much as giving me the opportunity to open my mind and speak my mind and grapple with interesting ideas that weren't always, they're not always accepted by all communities. And, you know, this, to me, the American dream becomes this idea of open discourse and, you know, interacting with people on the basis of logic and mostly politics, because that's what I do for life, and I enjoy talking to people about what they're thinking of is, about what Americanness is, and contrasting it to my own experiences. I do this, as a matter of fact, all the time, compare with other countries that I've been to, and I've been to several, and live there. So it is an interesting contrast when when you see countries that their American dream means for them safety and material wealth, and, you know, to me means openness in terms of ideas and that kind of discourse. Again, that also points out to the, you know, fairly open nature of the United States and its ability to attract people for that reason, freedom, basically, of expression is a powerful motivator for people to join the United States. And that's why also it is a little bit concerning towards people now turn against immigrants and immigration, especially from places where this ability to speak your mind does not exist at all. It seems to me that I would have been denied a wonderful experience and wonderful personal development, you know, not to mention the community. So I think this turn against immigrants is concerning and unfortunate, and it would not help positively, speaking basically on my own personal experience. I do realize that there is a lot of policy concerns that come with it, but that would be my take on why I would be here and what the American dream means to me.
This concludes this evening's program. Join us next month when our theme will be meaning. A special thanks to tonight's guests, Professor Akis Kalitzidis, Professor Bill Black, and V. Tran. Also, a big thanks to musical guests, Betsy Ellis, Clark Wyatt, and Brett Hodges. And thank you to our engineer, Bill Kloss. We are Julie Bennett-Hume and Scott Easterday wishing you a good evening from River City, Chautauqua.